Today is Wednesday, February 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the results from Tuesday's primary in New Hampshire as the contest claims one Democrat campaign.
You know, I am the math guy, and it is clear tonight from the numbers that we are not going to win this race.
Plus, the latest on the coronavirus outbreak as it gets a formal name, and Lebanon will ask the International Monetary Fund for technical assistance. We'll have all those stories and more coming up next. The northeastern state of New Hampshire went to the polls on Tuesday in the nation's first primary contest ahead of this November's general election to elect the next president. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders narrowly won Tuesday, solidifying his frontrunner status in the White House race.
The reason that we won tonight in New Hampshire, we won last week in Iowa. It's because of the hard work of so many volunteers. And let me say tonight that this victory here is the beginning of the end for Donald Trump.
Now joining us in the studio to break down Tuesday's results is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, welcome.
Hi, Steve.
So Bernie Sanders, the big winner. There are some surprising results, you know, coming out of the New Hampshire primary.
Some people are debating how big a winner he is. I think it's clear that he has solidified the sort of progressive lane in the Democratic Party. That's at the expense primarily of Elizabeth Warren, who finished fourth. I think it's fair to say Sanders has the most committed group of people. He relies on younger voters, progressive liberals. But it was also clear from the results with the rise of Pete Buttigieg based on his performance in Iowa and especially Amy Klobuchar, who came in third. They're both candidates who appeal to moderates. Moderates are looking for someone to take on Donald Trump in the fall. They're not convinced Bernie Sanders is the one. This dynamic is going to go on for a while. It makes for a perhaps long and difficult battle within the party.
Speaking of in the party, Joe Biden came in very late to the list of candidates, 26 at one time. He finished fourth in Iowa, fifth here in New Hampshire. What does it say about his campaign, given that these are two small states with not very diverse populations?
Right. I mean, this is the way the tradition is in the United States. These states kick it off. It's been this way for a long time. But it's true, they don't necessarily, especially for Democrats, reflect the broader, more demographically diverse populations. Biden was leading all of 2019, let's not forget, in national polls. Has he turned out to be somewhat of a paper tiger? So far he has. He's now staking his campaign on doing well in South Carolina at the end of the month. That is a state with a large African-American population. It's the most important constituency for Democrats in that state. He'll need to probably win there to revive his campaign. But here's the thing. The results are not really inducing any of the major candidates to get out of the race yet because it's very unclear how they move forward. And although Sanders is coalescing young voters and liberals, he's not winning over moderates. And there's a growing cry for a moderate alternative, and that's where Michael Bloomberg may come in later in the month.
Do you expect to see more candidates drop out in the time that we have left here, about 40 seconds? We saw Andrew Yang has already canceled his campaign.
Yeah, you may see some of the more fringe candidates who have just not registered with voters, like the former governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, for example. But the focus is on the top five or six, including Bloomberg, and what happens, especially leading up to Super Tuesday on March 3rd.
Great to have you, as always, with your analysis here in the studio. VOA's national correspondent, Jim Malone, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
U.S. President Donald Trump on Wednesday praised U.S. Attorney General William Barr for, quote, taking charge of the case against longtime Trump advisor and friend Roger Stone as House Democrats threatened to investigate the Justice Department's actions. VOA's Jeff Custer has more.
Senior department officials, hours after Trump complained on Twitter that Stone was being treated unfairly, overrode the prosecuting attorney's sentence recommendation. The federal attorneys who had secured Stone's conviction had recommended that the judge sentence him to 7 to 9 years in prison. All four prosecutors then quit the case after the highly unusual reversal. Stone was found guilty in November on 7 counts of lying to Congress, obstruction, and witness tampering. In a new court filing, a Justice Department official who had not previously worked on the case called that recommendation excessive and unwarranted and said the department would not make a formal sentencing recommendation. Legal experts described the Justice Department's move as highly unusual. Democrats accused Attorney General William Barr, who heads the department, of working to protect Trump's political interests. Chuck Schumer, the top Senate Democrat, asked the department's internal watchdog to investigate. Democrat Gerald Nadler, chairman of the House of Representatives Judiciary Committee, said he would also investigate the reversal. Sentencing is expected February 20th. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
U.S. President Donald Trump suggested on Tuesday that the Pentagon should review the conduct of former White House national security aide who played a central role in the Democrats' impeachment case and potentially consider disciplinary action against him. Army Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman testified before the House impeachment panel that Mr. Trump inappropriately pushed Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Vindman was ousted from his job on the White House National Security Council last Friday, just 2 days after the Senate acquitted Mr. Trump on abuse of power and obstruction of justice charges. President Trump has been sharply criticized for pushing out Alexander Vindman and others who crossed him during the impeachment hearings. Robert O'Brien, Trump's national security advisor, said on Tuesday that Alexander Vindman had not asked to leave his White House job in retaliation for his testimony. O'Brien suggested that Vindman was not acting to implement the president's policies decisions. Defense Secretary Mark Esper was asked earlier what the Pentagon would do to ensure that the former NSC staffers face no retribution. He said, quote, "We protect all of our service members from retribution or anything like that. We've already addressed that in policy and other means," end quote. The U.S. Senate will vote this week on a resolution aimed at restricting U.S. President Donald Trump from taking military action against Iran without congressional authorization. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine, who sponsored the resolution, says he intends to prevent another U.S. military engagement in the Middle East. Tuesday, senators on the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee heard testimony on the state of the American engagement in Afghanistan, the longest military conflict in U.S. history. VOA's Ardita Dunalari has that story.
To order this hearing,
U.S. senators listened as John Sopko, the nation's top inspector general for U.S. reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan, delivered a grim report. The U.S. effort is failing to meet major objectives and overall lacks transparency, he said, in part because of stonewalling by Afghan authorities and U.S. agencies attempting to cover up failures and mismanagement.
Every time we find something that looks like it's going negative, it gets classified or it's no longer relevant.
As a result, Sopko said Congress and the American public aren't getting an accurate picture of U.S. reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan.
I can't tell you publicly how well a job we're doing on training. So those $64 billion has gone for training and assisting the Afghan military. And I can't tell you or the American people. And that's in part because we allow the Afghan government to classify what I can tell you.
Richard Boucher, former Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia during the Bush administration, described it as a failed strategy to build a stable governance based on a misguided understanding of realities on the ground.
But overall, we failed and still failed to build stability because we failed to empower the Afghan government to deliver the benefits of governments to Afghans at the local level.
The Afghanistan engagement serves as an important lesson in the war on terror, said Ambassador Boucher.
We need to lead with diplomacy backed by a military capability, not the other way around. And most importantly, we need to fund diplomacy so that America can lead.
The former diplomat added that U.S. intervention in Afghanistan has run its course.
In my view, it's time to come home.
As the race for the White House heats up, there is a renewed talk about ending the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan. In his State of the Union address, President Donald Trump repeated his promise to end America's wars in the Middle East. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate will vote Wednesday on a resolution sponsored by Democratic Senator Tim Kaine to limit the president's ability to order military action without congressional authorization. The measure originated out of concern that President Trump may conduct military strikes against Iran after U.S. troops killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is calling on members of the chamber to defeat the resolution, saying that it would severely limit the U.S. military's operational flexibility to defend itself against threats posed by Iran. Ardita Dunelari, VOA News, Washington.
A U.S. Taliban peace deal could be signed this month if the Taliban significantly reduces violence, and that deal could lead to the withdrawal of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. That comes from two Afghan sources and a Western diplomat speaking to Reuters News. The talks had been deadlocked in part over a U.S. demand. The insurgents agreed to significantly reduce violence as part of any American troop withdrawal accord. The coronavirus outbreak in China, now known by its official name as the COVID-19, may be over by April. That's the optimistic news shared by China's senior medical advisor. But WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus told reporters Tuesday not to take the outbreak lightly.
This outbreak is testing us in many ways. It's a test of political solidarity. Whether the world can come together to fight a common enemy that does not respect borders or ideologies. It's a test of financial solidarity, whether the world will invest now in fighting this outbreak or pay more later to deal with its consequences. And it's a test of scientific solidarity. Will the world come together to find shared answers to shared problems?
He also issued this warning to governments of the world.
But a virus can have more powerful consequences than any terrorist action. And that's true. And if the world doesn't want to wake up and consider this enemy virus as public enemy number one, I don't think we will learn from our lessons.
China has announced another drop in the number of new virus cases, but also 97 more deaths nationally. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has more.
China says its figures show just over 2,000 new cases, a second daily decline. The total number of cases in mainland China now is just over 44,000, although many experts believe a large number of others infected have gone uncounted. Officials say the new fatality figure of nearly 100 pushes the total dead past 1,100. One repercussion of the virus is that postal services worldwide are seeing delivery affected by the cancellation of many flights to China, with the US Postal Service saying it's experiencing significant difficulties in getting mail to the China region. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
We'll have additional updates as the story continues to develop. And still to come,
Lebanese security forces clash with protesters in Beirut trying to stop a confidence vote in parliament on the new cabinet they say does not meet their demands, nor can save Lebanon from economic disaster.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers at the Chinese Academy of Sciences are reporting that they have discovered a giant stellar black hole in our Milky Way galaxy. The discovery came as a big surprise to the Chinese astronomers. Lead astronomer Liu Jifeng says that according to most current models of stellar evolution, black holes of such mass should not even exist in our galaxy. The huge stellar black hole has been named LB1. It has a mass 70 times greater than the Sun and is located 15,000 light-years from Earth. Scientists currently list four types of black holes: stellar, intermediate, supermassive, and miniature. Stellar black holes are formed by the gravitational collapse of a star. And until this discovery, stellar black holes had a mass of no more than 20 times that of the Sun. The discovery was reported in the journal Nature. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Lebanon will ask the International Monetary Fund for technical assistance to draw up a stabilization plan for its financial and economic crisis, including how to restructure its public debt. That's from a government source speaking to Reuters News. The request comes a day after Lebanese security forces clashed with protesters in Beirut trying to stop a confidence vote in parliament. The new cabinet, they say, does not meet their demands nor can save Lebanon from economic disaster. At least 150 people are reported injured in the Tuesday confrontations. A chief demand of the demonstrators is a government made up of technocrats who would not have sectarian affiliations. But some analysts say, like it or not, Lebanon's sectarian system is necessary given the tiny Mediterranean country's diverse population that includes 18 religious sects. Dale Gavlak has that story.
Lebanese security forces fired tear gas and water cannons at hundreds of Lebanese demonstrators descending on parliament who were trying to stop a vote ushering in the new government of Prime Minister Hassan Diab. "No confidence," they shouted, holding Lebanese flags of red and white with the iconic green cedar in the center. Some demonstrators damaged the exterior of a bank and threw rocks at police. The parliamentary gathering comes amid a crippling economic and financial crisis, Lebanon's worst in decades. Some protesters say that even if the new government is approved, it does not represent the majority of Lebanese who have been protesting against the political establishment since October. Swiss-Lebanese-American analyst Mark Farha says while Lebanon must tackle a severe economic problem, including corruption, he does not agree with the demonstrations. He says in modern times, Lebanon's fragile sectarian system was less pronounced before the 1995 to 1990 civil war, and since has stoked divisions. But would getting rid of sectarianism really work?
In Lebanon, the problem is, if you have a direct numeric democracy, would it really change? Would the Hezbollah voter no longer vote for Hezbollah? He would still, right? Now, in the current system, he or she is forced to also vote on a list for a Christian and for a Sunni. So they're forced to do alliances. In a case like Lebanon, with these kind of divisions, it might exacerbate the problem.
Professor Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University says many Lebanese, in theory, want to see the end of the confessional or sectarian system. He says, however, it could be the last nail in the coffin for some of these minorities.
There are many drawbacks to the sectarian system in Lebanon, but one advantage is that it has provided some degree of protection, cover, and the maintenance of certain basic rights for demographically vulnerable communities.
Malik says without the rule of law and the respect of minority rights first established in Lebanon, scrapping the sectarian system won't work. The unprecedented wave of protests cutting across sectarian identities is demanding an end to the hereditary political elite, viewed as both corrupt and incompetent. Lebanon is facing a crisis rooted in decades of state waste and corruption that has been fueling public anger. Entrenched Shiite Parliament Speaker Nebi Barry says Lebanon may need help from the International Monetary Fund to draw up an economic rescue plan and to decide whether to pay a Eurobond, which is underwritten by several countries and matures in March. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
Syrian media said Wednesday that a Syrian civilian was killed and another was wounded when U.S. troops opened fire on locals who had tried to block a U.S. convoy from driving through a checkpoint in a village in the country's northeast. The U.S. military spokesman said after the coalition issued a series of warnings and de-escalation attempts, the patrol came under small arms fire from unknown individuals. No coalition personnel were harmed. A Pakistani court has convicted Hafiz Saeed and sentenced him to two separate charges for a total of approximately 11 years. The ruling came ahead of a meeting of the World Financial Watchdog Financial Action Task Force next week to decide whether to blacklist Pakistan for failing to curb terrorism financing. Saeed, the head of the Lashkar-e-Taiba group, considered responsible for the devastating Mumbai attacks in India in 2008, was placed on the terrorist list of both the United States and the United Nations Security Council. Saeed's lawyer said he would appeal. Pope Francis declined Wednesday to approve the ordination of married men to address the priest shortage in the Amazon, sidestepping a fraught issue long debated in the Catholic Church and even involved retired Pope Benedict XVI. In an eagerly awaited document, Francis didn't even refer to recommendations by Amazonian bishops to consider the ordinations of married men and women deacons. Rather, Francis urged bishops to pray for more priestly vocations and send missionaries to the region, where the faithful living in remote communities can go months or even years without Mass. 23-year-old Vanessa Nakate has held weekly Fridays for Future protests in Kampala, Uganda, demanding action against climate change. Nakate spoke to VOA's Jason Patinkin from Kampala about what African governments' youth must do to address climate change, which is hitting African nations hard.
Last week, we still had the Fridays for Future climate strike with other climate activists from Uganda. And this is something that is going to go on even for the coming weeks, because we already have a strike that we are planning for this week on Friday. We hope to invite more people to join us. Every week we are out on the streets demanding for climate action.
You're protesting, I believe, outside Parliament. So what would you like to see the Ugandan government specifically be doing regarding climate?
First of all, I need the Ugandan government to acknowledge we are facing a climate crisis right now, because the only way that we can handle the issue of climate change and try to address it is by, first of all, accepting that we are in a crisis right now, and also educating people, because many people are not aware about the fact that we are facing climate change, especially farmers from rural areas. They can no longer predict their rain seasons. They can no longer predict their, you know, the dry season. So if we told them, if they had a knowledge of what causes all that, it should be good for them to know exactly what to do to try and solve the problem. You know, when we are done with the acceptance of the crisis, then the government needs to start actually solving the crisis. For example, watching the investments that come into the government, into the country, making sure that these investments are not going to increase CO2 emissions into the atmosphere, as well as provision of accessible and affordable renewable energy. Most people have failed to adjust to renewable energy simply because of how expensive it is. But if the government would find a way of making it cheap and affordable for the citizens, it would be an easier transition for every individual. I would want my government to ensure protection of existing forest cover, because the forests are one of the carbon sinks that we have, and it is really important to protect them, because literally our existence depends on the existence of the entire ecosystem.
It is said that Africa is actually the continent that will be most affected by climate change, and African people will bear the brunt of the negative impacts of climate change. Yet at the same time, Africa is the smallest contributor to climate change. What can African people and the African governments do to pressure the rest of the world to take stronger action against climate change?
The African Union and the African government and the African people need to rise up together and demand for action, and also demand for compensation from some of the countries that have led to this mess and are still fueling up the mess and the crisis that we are facing right now. You were right when you say that African countries are going to be the most affected, but I must say that it's no longer a problem of the future. They are already being affected by the climate crisis.
And that was Ugandan climate activist Vanessa Nakate speaking to my VOA colleague Jason Patinkin. And finally, a Japanese man with a sweet tooth who believes that smiles have become the world's oldest male at 112 years and 344 days old. That's according to the Guinness World Records. That's Chitetsu Watanabe. By the way, the oldest living female is also in Japan, Kane Tanaka, at 117. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Dan Brown, and engineer, Zubair, thank you very much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have an absolutely fantastic day.